We're continuing on in Hebrews, and if you guys have been tracking along with us, we're in the second part of chapter 12 now, and we're getting close to the end. There's 13 chapters in Hebrews. He's kind of building with this crescendo, and with it, all these images are coming out, right? And if you were here last week, we talked about this race that is being run, and the discipline involved with this race. And then he switches gears with discipline and kind of flows into this area of this fatherly discipline that is occurring. A God who sees us as children running this race. I was just, the image, Mary Blanton's here somewhere, but I was like, all of a sudden we went from this like LA marathon to like the jogathon at El Moro, right? Like that we're running this race, but we're all kind of these little kids. And need that kind of parental reassurance that comes. I was thinking today as we go, he shifts to just one more metaphor, that as we go from mountains, we move from parental discipline, or I mean not mountains, we races to discipline, to now mountains today. We're going to see these two mountains that are in front of us, and how all of a sudden now, life is not just merely a race, but it's a climb. And so let me read our passage. I'm going to kind of lay it all out there in front of us, and then we'll kind of pull it apart and see the tension between these two mountains. As we set out on our journey, which of these mountains are we to climb? The mountain of fear and the mountain of joy. Hebrews 12:18. You have not come to a mountain that can be touched and that is burning with fire, to darkness, gloom, and storm, to a trumpet blast or such a voice speaking words that those who heard it begged that no further word be spoken to them, because they could not bear what was commanded. If even an animal touches the mountain, it must be stoned to death. The sight was so terrifying that Moses said, "I am trembling with fear." But you have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. You've come to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly, to the church of the firstborn whose names are written in heaven. You've come to God, the judge of all, to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better world, a better word than the blood of Abel. See to it that you do not refuse him who speaks. If they did not escape when they refused him who warned them on earth, how much less will we if we turn away from him who warns us from heaven? At that time his voice shook the earth. But now he has promised, once more I will shake not only the earth but also the heavens. The words once more indicate the removing of what can be shaken, that is, created things, so that what cannot be shaken may remain. Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, let us be thankful and so worship God acceptably with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. The word of the Lord. We're talking here about this mountain that cannot be shaken. If I was going to title this sermon, that's what I would title it: The Mountain That Cannot Be Shaken. And I love this metaphor, I think, because I've always felt inspired by the mountains. I grew up camping and then backpacking and eventually rock climbing. It always was kind of in my blood. I had a chance to take my daughter recently out to Joshua Tree. And I think it's funny, just by way of observation, we've been climbing in a gym forever. When I climb in a rock climbing gym, I'm climbing like 11B, 11C, like, and I think, I never, when I was younger, used to climb that grade. Like, I wonder if I'm better than I ever was. And then you go out to Joshua Tree, these old roots, and you get on like a 5.9, and it just destroys you, right? This, like, decimal system that you realize, like, has eroded over time. It's like such a revealing of human tendency, right? Where we're like, we change the grade around what we can do as opposed to the other way around. And then you go out and you try something difficult, and it humbles you, but hopefully inspires you as well. these. Does that make sense, what I'm talking about there? A grade where you're like, oh my goodness, like that's what a 5'9 feels like. But there's something about that sort of truth, right, that like creates an expectation. And the mountains are like that. Adventure is like that. There's what we imagine it to be. And then you go out and then you're tested truly. The mountains are this place of adventure, which take us to our limits and beyond that. I love the Yvon Chouinard quote where he says, it's not an adventure till something goes wrong. And climbing like that has been like that. There's always a fear that comes with it a little bit. That's like part of the rush. And it always kind of shapes the power of like the vista when you reach the top. A lot of it is determined by how much effort it took to get there. When you sit there at the top of the climb and look at the beauty of that. If it's in Yosemite, it doesn't get better than that. You look at this valley beneath you and you just go, oh, thanks be to God. And that's a good day of climbing. There are plenty of bad days, plenty of frustrations, plenty of fears, falls that come along with it, injuries. I've got pins in my ankle as a result of a really bad fall climbing. But it humbles us and inspires us, and this climb is necessary. But I recently was watching the movie Everest on Netflix. How many of you have watched this? Okay, go watch it. I mean, unless you're like, well, I don't know. My hands sweat when I watch it. But it's the documentary. It's a movie that was made off of Krakauer's book, Into Thin Air. Has anybody read this book? John Krakauer, fantastic writer, talks about this expedition that he was a part of on Everest that, spoiler, didn't go as planned, right? That these people reached the summit and yet were hit by this storm and the sort of chaos that spirals afterwards. I, as a confession, will admit that I can't watch the whole thing. I've like read it. I know what's going to happen. There's this moment where they get like to the Hillary Step. They've summited there. Well, this guy Rob is the guide, and his good friend is giving his second attempt on Everest, and they're this close to the top, and he's going, we missed it. We missed the window. You got to go back down. And his friend's like, please, please, just take me to the top. And every time I watch that movie, I'm thinking, Rob, this time, don't take him. This time, say no, please. And then he says yes. I'm like, dang it, Rob, why? And the sort of disaster that takes place. Krakauer goes along, and he's working for Outside Magazine, and he goes along to kind of document this. And there's a quote that he gives at the beginning of Into Thin Air that I think is kind of haunting to me. He writes this about summiting. He said, I'd been fantasizing about this moment and the release of emotion that would accompany it for many months. But now that I was finally here, actually standing on the summit of Mount Everest, I just couldn't summon the energy to care. And I thought, reading that line, right, this is like, there's no bigger mountain to climb. It's an interesting thing to talk about this effort to reach that summit. This is the pinnacle of it. And here he is standing at the top going, huh, that's it. And the sort of depression that must, you know, come with that. Like, what's next? Like, honestly, nothing. I remember watching this video of that wave in kind of Central Coast, more Northern California. Mavericks is this massive wave there. And there's this guy, Peter Mell, who's about my age, who finally caught this wave there where he, if you're a surfer, he like backdoors the peak. He comes from like the wrong side of the peak, so deep onto this wave, and the thing barrels over him. And the people that were filming didn't even catch that he was on the wave. He was so far back when he rode this thing. And everybody's like, this is like the wave of his life. And I saw an interview with him afterwards, and they were like, how do you feel? And he's like, kind of sad. Like, this was the wave I was searching for my whole life. And isn't that interesting? I mean, this to me is such like the human condition, that we have these goals and these things that we seek to attain, these mountains we want to climb. and the danger of putting all our hope in potentially the wrong mountain, the one that fails to give us what we're truly hoping for. We see these two mountains in our text, and with this metaphor, there's a warning here to make sure that we are climbing the mountain that ultimately matters, as opposed to the one that's going to shake and fall. Any book that's on coaching and leadership warns us of this. That goal that you're setting out for, when you attain it, it's not going to give you what you think. And yet it doesn't stop us from pursuing it. And in some ways, I think what I want to talk about today is maybe it's not supposed to stop us. Maybe what we have to do is climb that mountain and realize that it's not enough. The danger is, I think, for us, as we start to get frustrated with our own climb, we have this tendency to then turn around and instill all those values into our children, don't we? Like, well, if I didn't attain it, maybe you can, right? Or if it didn't work for me, maybe I could somehow vicariously attain that mountain through my children. I was reading this recently that Harvard Graduate School of Education had done this survey where they asked 10,000 children, middle school and high school, if their parents cared more about personal achievement or whether they were kind. You could probably see where I'm going with this. The response was personal achievement over kindness. But you want to know how many kids said that? 80%. Of those kids, 8 out of 10,000 kids said, my parents are more concerned with personal achievement than kindness. So we're shaping a culture around climbing this mountain that consistently, again and again, fails to give us what we're longing for. And our passage holds these two mountains up and names the second one, not the first, but it's pretty clear what the first mountain is in our text today. And that mountain is Sinai. This was a mountain where the people of Israel were given the law, the Ten Commandments. And in our text today, we see that the image of this mountain is one of like the power of God revealed in a way that is terrifying. In Hebrews, going back to our text, it says, a mountain that is burning with fire, to darkness, gloom, and storm, to a trumpet blast, or to such a voice speaking words that those who heard it begged that no further word be spoken to them, because they could not bear what was commanded. On the top of this mountain, on the top of this place where the law is given, what people see is their inadequacy. That God is this measure of holiness and a sort of holiness that we can never attain. We can never climb high enough. And this is a reference going all the way back to Exodus 19. And I thought I'd just read these words for us. It says, on the morning of the third day, there was thunder and lightning with a thick cloud over the mountains and a very loud trumpet blast. Everyone in the camp trembled. When Moses led the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain, and Mount Sinai was covered with smoke because the Lord descended on it in fire. The smoke billowed up from it, smoke from a furnace. And the whole mountain trembled violently as the sound of the trumpet grew louder. Moses spoke, and the voice of God answered. What is all of this? What is this smoke and this fire and all of these images? What's going on? Well, this is God's presence drawing near, or what we might call the judgment that comes with God's presence. That when we see ourselves and our condition before God, almost the right response is trembling, like, woe is me. And this happens again and again through Scripture, no matter who it is. Isaiah sees God and he's like, woe is me, right? God's prophet shaking. This idea of encountering something that's so much larger than us, that fills us with not just awe, but as it turns out, with a sense of dread. And God on Mount Sinai makes this covenant with his people. And this covenant is this promise, and it's this promise of blessing, but it's one that comes with conditions. Here's what's expected of you. Here's what it takes to live a life that is holy. Here's the standard set up for you. And this idea of a sort of conditional love of God, this becomes the first encounter of these people with it. Who qualifies? And as we see as the story goes on, nobody. Nobody attains this standard. Nobody is capable. As Paul writes, there's no one righteous, no, not one. Hence the need for a new covenant, a new promise, a new way, a second mountain. And in our text, this second mountain is described, and it's very different. God is there. In fact, God dwells there, and his presence is there, and even his judgment is there. But instead of this doom, it's this place of joy and of worship. Hebrews 12:22 says, "But you've come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. You've come to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly, to the church of the firstborn whose names are written in heaven. You've come to God, the judge of all, to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant." This idea of this mountain of joy, this place of coming home, this is the promised land. This has been the destination all along. It's this place of transformation where we are set right, made whole, fixed, healed, restored. I love this idea of angels singing. And it's this idea of them just marveling at who God is. This fear of judgment has been removed. Something has happened between these two mountains. And we see it here in our text. You've come to God, the judge of all, the spirits of righteous made perfect, to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant. And this mediation in between, this is what separates these two promises, these two covenants. That judgment exists in both, but looks very different in the second case. And why? Well, this new covenant that is done is what God has taken upon himself. The new covenant we've been talking about all along through Hebrews, this comes through God, this comes through Jesus, a better sacrifice. This comes through Jesus, a better promise, a better way. Not Moses, but Christ. These are the contrast between the old and the new. And just for clarity's sake, I just threw up this little chart here. These are the two, the old covenant versus the new covenant, and they're so distinct. But Sinai versus Zion, Mountain 1 versus Mountain 2, the first written on stone, these commandments that were given, the new covenant written on our hearts, the first covenant based on law keeping, the second based on grace, the third distance from God, couldn't even touch the mountain. This, the veil torn, access to God, mediated by Moses, this one being mediated by Christ. The first covenant conditional, the second unconditionally offered through Christ. The old covenant, one of sacrifice of an animal. The new covenant, Jesus, once and for all. And this new covenant is prophesied as the Old Testament is coming to a close. These prophets start speaking of this, especially Jeremiah. He says it so beautifully in these words of God that says, "This covenant I will make with the people of Israel after that time, declares the Lord. I will put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts. I will be their God. They will be my people. No longer will they teach their neighbor or say to one another, 'Know the Lord,' because they will all know me, from the least of them to the greatest, declares the Lord. For I will forgive their wickedness and will remember their sins no more." On the night of Jesus' betrayal, he holds out this cup and says, "This is my blood of the covenant, poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins." This covenant, this promise, this is, as we're approaching Easter, what our eyes are fixed on. Not just the power of resurrection, but the price of the cross. And what occurs there. And as we see in these images of a shaking world, darkness falling, that this symbol reoccurs there at the cross. That at the death of Jesus, the earth shakes and the sky goes dark. That God's presence is there and his judgment at that moment. And in Matthew 27, it says, when Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. That's our access in. The earth shook as the rocks split and the tombs broke open. What's happening here? The very thing that occurred at Sinai, the presence of God drew near. The earth shakes. And what we see in all of these images is an earth that shakes. One, unbearably, but the latter shaking is this revealing, a demonstration of the work that God has done, that Jesus has done on our behalf, that this judgment that made Moses tremble on top of Sinai has been resolved in Jesus. That debts are paid, things are set right, accounts are rectified. Now, thinking about myself as a kid in Sunday school, the question I would have asked is this: why wouldn't you just lead with Jesus? Have any of you thought about that? Why do you need an old covenant? Why not just the new covenant be covenant number one? I think that's what I would have done, right? Let's forget Sinai. Let's just go straight to the grace. And I think in my way of thinking, I like the way that fits, but I think there's some truth in this that maybe we need. That without Sinai, we fail to see the depth of what needs to be fixed and restored. We need this first mountain to get us to the end of our rope. We need it to come to this place where I'm not enough. That this second mountain is a mountain that we climb in this posture of surrender. And until we finish climbing Sinai and realizing that that summit isn't going to give us what we thought it was, I think we fail to understand the depth of this second climb or the significance of this second climb. The pride lurking down there has to be drawn out, that so much work has to be done in order to get us to this place where we can experience the joy of heaven. We've been reading through Lent this book, The Great Divorce, and it's about these creatures are like, well, humans, but they're phantoms arriving in heaven, and it's so real they can't step on the grass. They think of themselves as full and complete until they experience the light of heaven and they realize that they're translucent, that you could see right through them, that the substance is lacking. And that heaven itself is this truth. It's this weight. It's this glory that they're not prepared for. And then the journey then for them to enter in is going to require humility. They're going to have to lean on somebody for support. And this second climb, it's so counterintuitive that I think as we see in Hebrews, this warning that's being given, because people are coming to Jesus and then wanting to go back to Sinai because that's the place where we have control. It's still about me. It's about my achievement and my individuation and my significance. The climb towards Zion is letting go of all that stuff. Letting go of my self-importance. Letting go of my self-centeredness. My need for control. The example of this that I think captures it, in my opinion, very beautifully is Jesus talking to who we refer to as the rich young ruler. Do you remember this story? This is like the John Krakauer of religious people. This is the climber that comes into Jesus going, what else should I do? What's the next mountain to climb? And in Mark 10, it says this, as Jesus started on his way, a man ran up to him and fell on his knees before him. Good teacher, he asked, what must I do to inherit eternal life? Why do you call me good? Jesus answered, no one is good except God alone. You know the commandments. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not give false testimony. You shall not defraud. Honor your father and mother. Teacher, he declared, all these I have kept since I was a boy. Jesus looked at him and loved him. One thing you lack, he said, go sell everything and give to the poor, and you'll have treasure in heaven. Then come follow me. At this, the man's face fell. He went away sad because he had great wealth. And I've said this before. What I hear in Jesus' words, this is not Jesus, in my opinion. This is not him embarrassing this man. It's not a way of shaming him for his possessions. What I hear is not condemnation. I hear invitation. This man has climbed the first mountain and saying, what else is there? And Jesus says, the second mountain requires you just give all that stuff away. That's not the point. And really, in the end, what I hear in Jesus is like, come with me. Come with me up this second mountain. This is the journey that brings joy and freedom, where the small things are set aside, where all the little petty things that we clutch to are released. It's this narrow way, but it's this way to life. David Brooks ended up writing a book that he referred to as The Second Mountain, where he talks about this journey. And he talks about this first mountain as one of individualism. And he says, individualism says you have to love yourself first before you can love others. But the second mountain ethos says you have to be loved first so you can understand love. You have to see yourself actively loving others so that you know you are worthy of love. On the first mountain, a person makes individual choices and keeps their options open. The second mountain is a veil of promise making. It's about making commitments, tying oneself down, and giving oneself away. The second mountain is costly. At least that's how it appears. But the author of Hebrews is saying, that's the stuff that can't go with you into heaven anyways. All that you're losing is the stuff that just is shaken off as life gets hard or judgment hits. This shaking, that's like the husk that falls away. And this way, this path, this idea of giving up, this is the way of the cross that Jesus invites us to. He doesn't say, I took my cross so you don't have to, right? He says, take up your cross and follow. And this to me is the warning here in this text, where he's saying, some of you will refuse this. And he's not talking about people that refuse God. He's talking about people that refuse grace, that go back to the law, that go back to the achievement, that go back to those things that ultimately are about us. The author says, see to it that you do not refuse him who speaks. And these are Christians he's talking to. It's not for people outside of the faith. And this idea, why would you return? Why would you return to the mountain of shaking and doom and all of this? And again, like in our great divorce study, you see why. Pride. That shows up in so many different ways, whether it's our rights or it's that thing that we just can't bear to give up. That thing we clutch to, that thing that we think gives our life all its sense of security and meaning and purpose. And these paths, as it turns out, it's not just a going back, but that these two realities cannot coexist, that those things cannot endure, that selfishness cannot endure in heaven. In Mount Zion, it too will shake, and those things will fall away. Matthew 6:24, Jesus says, no one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. And we've talked about this plenty. I mean, money isn't the problem, right? It's so often the trigger, however. And that could be possessions, that could be talents, that could be so many things. And Paul is clear. He's like, in poverty or prosperity, right? That here's, there's just one answer. I can do all things through Christ. That this place for us is this posture of surrender. If we stay there, this is going to upend our life. But it will allow us to hold the things of this world without them taking root. Steve sent me this article that in the Atlantic that's on this kind of outbreak of Christianity in Silicon Valley. Did anybody read this article? It showed up first as a Vanity Fair piece, and this person in the Atlantic is referring to it. This idea that Christianity is like booming in some of these different sectors, and they're going, wow, isn't it interesting? Silicon Valley, all these like, you know, young entrepreneurs are finding Jesus. But they're writing about it kind of critically. And this one person comments, and I just think this is interesting, right? Realize these are secular news sources commenting on this, but one person was quoted in the Vanity Fair article saying, I guarantee you there are people that are leveraging Christianity to get closer to Peter Thiel. But even if a significant proportion of the new believers are entirely sincere, that doesn't mean their theology is copacetic. Christianity, they ought to know, is not a life hack. It's a life-upending surrender to the fact of divine love. I loved that last line. They ought to know it is not a life hack. It's a life-upending surrender to the fact of divine love. I wonder how many of us take Christianity on as like this clever little life hack. Do you know what that means? Like, oh yeah, like you can get that sort of virtue morality thing in here too that could sort of coexist with all of this. And whoever this is commenting in Vanity Fair is going, no, isn't this supposed to turn your whole life upside down? Isn't that what Jesus has been talking about? That this second mountain, when you climb it, it's going to turn your life upside down. Sinai may not, right? You still get to work out all this stuff on your own, except that just ends at a cold summit. This other way is upending, and yet is the place of life. The author in the Atlantic article writes this, and this is a larger quote, but bear with me here. I just thought it was interesting. She writes, this is key because if Christianity is true, if we really were created to love God and one another and were then rescued from our sins by the sacrificial intervention of Christ, then everything else one believes must flow downstream of that essential reality. Believers' personal philosophies, practices, and politics are all answerable to the Christian religion. There's no domain of life outside of God's interest, and he requires that all things be brought in accordance with his will. This means that economics is God's business, which is bad news for techno-libertarians because Christ's teaching decidedly militate against the rapacious acquisition of wealth. Now, personally, I don't put that up there as some sort of judgment on the techno-libertarians. I more go, wow, where does my life fall into this? How much of my life is sort of compartmentalized in this? Like, Jesus, you have access to these rooms and not these rooms. You have access to this part of my life, not this. Jesus, I'll give you this much of this, and then I'm going to hold on to this for myself over here. And here in these two secular news sources, they're going, shouldn't Christianity just change everything? And Jesus is like, thank you. It's what we've been talking about all along. This changes everything, and yet at the same time, the stuff that we're losing is the inconsequential stuff that we don't get to take with us beyond the grave. And we can create our own like sort of hybrid Christianity that makes us feel like a really strong climber. Like sometimes we need those grades that don't change that show us like, wow, I've got a long way to go. That's a gift that shows us, oh my goodness, I need to pull my life back to this thing that matters. heard this interview recently with N.T. Wright, and somebody was asking him this question, like, wow, there's all this growth that's happening in Christianity and these like real homogenous sectors. You know, that thing is really growing. Does that make you kind of rethink your strategy? And N.T. Wright, he's a bishop, and said, well, I'm sure they're growing something. I'm just not sure that's the church. Isn't that interesting? Right? Like, oh yeah, what does this look like? And last week we talked about it's this fruit of righteousness, of peace. That this work, when we are surrendering and giving up, is creating in us deep virtue. Peace and patience and kindness. These things are so significant. And yet we see them as secondary to our accomplishments and the things that we attain and the splash that we make for ourselves. Zion is going like, when that shakes, when this mountain shakes, all that stuff is going to fall away. There's a fire there that just consumes all those little things. Our whole CV is like, poof, gone. Here's my resume, poof. And we're left with our heart there before God. This is what remains. And he says in the end of our chapter, therefore, since we're receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, let us be thankful and so worship God acceptably with reverence and awe. For our God is a consuming fire. And I think of times where God has come in and asked for things that I didn't want to let go of. Things that felt so costly. And yet what you find more often than not on the other side of those things is a freedom that comes. A release that those good things that you feel like you're giving up end up coming back around anyways. That we don't lose those things ultimately. That every good and perfect gift remains. And it takes trust. It takes surrender, and it takes this in an ongoing sense that we'll spend the rest of our lives climbing this mountain. Let's make sure we're climbing the right one. And so I thought, well, I'm just going to give you guys some questions that might help us determine which mountain we're climbing. Fair enough? Six little litmus tests to go. Am I climbing Sinai or am I climbing Zion? And the first is this simple question, what am I striving for? Often we know it when we don't get it, right? Like, oh, what was missing? But is it approval, achievement, security, being seen a certain way? Those are all these outward Sinai type of values. Or is it a deeper connection, faithfulness, joy, love? Number two, where do I locate my worth? Do I feel valuable because of what I do, how I appear, or what I own? Or do I know that I'm loved and chosen even when I fail? This second mountain is a mountain of grace that in humility you're like holding the hand of Jesus and he's like, hold on, we got this. Number three, how do I respond when life shakes? Do I double down and hustle harder or fall into fear? Or do I turn to God to allow the unraveling and trust something unshakable is being revealed? That is hard, right? This is, we talk over and over through this book about faith, and that's where faith really comes into play. How do I respond when life shakes? Number four, I talk about this all the time, but what do I avoid letting go of? Is there something I cling to that keeps me from joy? Success, control, resentment, an old identity. That comfort, right? I like how Brené Brown says, like, all of us were like, take the edge off aholics. What's that thing that I cling to for comfort that I just couldn't do without? Number five, is my life about climbing or about giving? Am I climbing a ladder or descending into love, service, community? Henry Nouwen calls this, the way of Jesus is the way of downward mobility. In some ways, you could picture the climb of Zion is actually a descent in many ways. And number six, what would I do if I really trusted that I was loved? And this God that we're negotiating with, this God that we're like on conditional terms with, is a God that we fear. And then we see Jesus as the revelation of who God really is. That this way of Zion, this faith, is rooted in this sense that we are loved and being loved into this kingdom. The work of the second mountain is not something we do, but something we let Christ do in us. That beautiful picture that he who began a good work in us will be faithful to complete it. So today I thought I'll close with our little bit of C.S. Lewis here that to me just captures the difference between these two mountains so beautifully. In the finished work that God is after in our hearts, he says this: morality is a mountain which we cannot climb by our own efforts. And if we could, we should only perish in the ice and unbreathable air of the summit, lacking those wings with which the rest of the life journey has to be accomplished. For it is from there that the real ascent begins. The ropes and axes are done away, and the rest is a matter of flying. Would you stand with me? Jesus, we thank you for the work that you are continually inviting us into, this work of transformation, to take hearts of stone and make them hearts of flesh, to turn us from these people striving after our own ambition into children that are surrendered and walking with you, but inviting us into this life of courageous living where our hearts are open in generosity. We are finding others in need, going towards those who are suffering, considering the least as most important. God, would you make us like this, these kind of people? And we thank you that as you do this work, God, that the fruit of this is joy, the reassurance of your love, and the ultimate promise of the destination that you're drawing us to. We love you. Amen.